This is what I was after during this trip. Extremists have once again risen from the ashes of Berlin, but this time with a different look and color.
The ultras are the most extreme supporters. They've been around for years and are well known for their racist and neo-fascist gestures. They are proud to use the fascist salute in honor of Mussolini.
To my mind, there are many overlapping ideas also between our new right-wing parties and the traditional fascism.
It's always dangerous to compare because history doesn't repeat itself. But it's true that we have now what has been called the third wave of radical rights in Europe. It started at the end of the 80s.
They tend to be anti-Semitism tends to be strong among them. And we don't see much of that in among the radical right parties like the Danish People's Party.
I think Americans supporting somehow right-wing populism tries to impose civil war in Europe, to return to the nationalism, to something like was the situation in the Second World War or First World War, in order to put Europe in turmoil and destroy it completely. To be torn apart by nationalisms.
The position of the far-right extremists is that the EU is a corrupt and bureaucratic union, something that has caused their countries to lose their borders, and their culture and identity are being attacked by illegal migrants. And that's why they expect that referendums are held as soon as possible and their countries exit the EU.
Our proposition, Eurasian proposition, multipolar proposition is quite different. Not to destroy Europe, but construct the Europe on the basis of traditional civilization, on the European values, limiting mass migration and returning to the Christian or Roman, Greek, Roman identity, but not to the bourgeois capitalist nationalism that will finish Europe.
Once someone told me that two things create today's Europe: shame of the events that happened and fear of the things that might happen. All the concepts that represent the EU, a common currency, a borderless continent, or extensive policies of accepting migrants, is this, the meeting of shame and fear. Like freedom, human rights, democracy, social responsibility, tolerance, and peace, they are all a high wall in front of past nightmares, the dream of a world which is nothing like the mid-20th century.
Polling Institute says anti-Semitism is much more prevalent in the AfD than in other parties.
Marcus Fuchs, the longtime spokesman of the AfD party, a group with positions and activities which have become extremely controversial, even in Germany. He's known as one of the most famous extremist right-wing personalities, even if he does not accept this himself. When Marcus was talking about his opinions, I did not feel they were irrational or scary. Who knows, maybe if I were a European citizen too, the things he said would be very exciting to me. Now I can understand why right-wing extremists are slowly taking over everywhere. The media, speaking halls, streets, and even parliaments.
If we try to understand the causes of the development of these far rights in Europe, there are many, but you can see two big categories. The first series is structural, long-term causes. It's a reaction to modernization, or more specifically what we call now, since the 90s, globalization. These rights have taken as their main platform the refusal of globalization, refusing the European integration, refusing the opening of borders. The second cause, and it's linked to it, is the delegitimization of the political class, of the mainstream parties, because there's the feeling that they're incapable of defending the country against globalization, which is seen as a cultural, economic, and political threat.
Far-right parties that now are gaining electoral support in Europe, they are kind of washing out these ideas with, they're cloaking it in another language. So one can say the language gets more and more narrative, more and more radical, the more you get into the underground, the other things are outspoken.
Because these rights, which had been delegitimized during World War II, wanted to reintegrate the parliamentary game. And for that, the only way to do it was to detach themselves completely from fascism and Nazism. And very quickly, they were called no more fascist rights, the right like the party of Jean-Marie Le Pen, created in 1972.
And at the beginning, it was a level of the public attention, the level of the public debate that condemned this sort of public expressions. And then with the time, slowly, the level of criticism, the level of taboo, the level of public alarm on this kind of statements. And now it's impressive how it's possible for a public, for example, a minister or a political leader, the chief of a political party, to publicly express.
There is an overrepresentation, but we should not exaggerate the extent to which higher educated and higher class voters would go to the more mainstream and lower educated people go to the radical right. Across the board, still, the majority of workers and lower educated people vote for mainstream parties. So we should not exaggerate that.
That have succeeded electorally are those who are the most far away from the model of fascism and Nazism, the old right, like the neo-Nazi small movements in Germany or the neo-fascist small movements in Italy, they don't take off electorally. And more recently, there's what you can call a fourth wave of far rights that have really no more connection with the past.
And these people who are beginning to find faith that the old beliefs about extremist rights are wrong are into taking action. For the first time after the Second World War, they sent representatives of a radical right party to the German parliament. Today, with younger and more charismatic leaders coming to power, the rights are slowly taking over the parliaments of different countries. What does the extremist right exactly want? Or let's put it this way, what exactly doesn't the extremist right want? The story is very simple. For the extremist rights, national identity is very important, and they oppose anything which wants to weaken or deteriorate it. Now, that could be the arrival of migrants who they think are unlike and different from their society or being part of a union that, according to them, puts them at the same level as other countries and brings their national sovereignty under question.
National communities are exclusive, and that we have this very strong idea of nativism combined with racism and xenophobia. And also ideas about the strong state, that it is the state that takes care of its citizens, and that the citizens are citizens of that state because of their nationality, something they are born with.
Many citizens feel that there are too many migrants and that Western societies are changing too rapidly as a result of migrants entering the country. And and radical right parties tap into these sentiments and these anti-immigration feelings, and that's what drives support for these kind of parties.
Now, Europe's fear and historical shame are gone, and this can bring the EU to its collapse. Tumult is on the rise on a daily basis in Europe. TV stations, platforms, the streets, everywhere is the scene of battle between the extremist right and their opposition. But today, we might be experiencing the foreshocks of a huge earthquake. This is where people might want to be the flag bearers of forces that want to return to the highest levels of power after years. Or at least, that's what many think. During the days I was wandering around in European cities and speaking with different experts, at times I would ask myself a question. As an Iranian, why would the re-emergence of the extremist right in Europe matter to me? Then I'd always come to a series of clear answers. I'd remember that in the past decade, a huge wave of people left the Middle East to reach Europe, including some of my own countrymen. I'd remember that extremist right-wing groups are against accepting migrants. I'd remember how entangled the policies of the European Union are with the destiny of my country, and that the right doesn't have the appetite to remain in the EU, and this itself can change a lot of things between Iran and Europe. I remembered that some of Europe's right-wing parties had strong relations with some of the most infamous terrorists in our country's history.
Populism, left populism or right populism in all European countries, now with populist left government in Spain, and growth of right populism of Vox there in Spain, and we have in all the country with Salvini in Italia, Salvini Fratelli d'Italia in Italia, AfD Alternative für Deutschland in Germany with Marine Le Pen. We see the European Union, it has already collapsed. So nobody could heal that. So there is no more, formally speaking, European Union.
During the 2 days that it took to make this documentary, these predictions came true. Today, Vox has 50 members in Spain's parliament and 3 in the European Parliament.
When it comes to explain the current situation, there are different theories around. One theory is it is fascism that is on the rise. Others argue it is nationalism.
Russia, please, if you can, get us Hillary Clinton's emails.
In a world where Trump is its most famous politician, dereliction of duty and trying to win over the most benefits are not strange. Just like fundamentalists in Islamic countries have a violent and illogical take on Islam, extremist rights are in favor of a fearsome proposal on modern capitalism. This 21st century proposal, even though different in each country, has commonalities as well. Extremist rights insist on their national identity. They do not want the European Union. They dislike migrants and letting them in. And they have serious positions against any group that challenges liberal traditions or creates disarray in the capitalism order. My trip to Europe didn't end with an answer. Instead, it made my questions more obvious. We are in the initial decades of the 21st century, and many believe that Europe is on the verge of returning to the situation of the first decades of the 20th century. If you don't forget that all world wars began from this beautiful continent, could these big and small weapon warehouses that pop up across Europe every once in a while, or these sudden killings which every once in a while shock the entire world, be a run-up to a huge nightmare? Is tomorrow the era of Europe's Trumps? These are questions that the green and beautiful continent of Europe has to answer, and we are all waiting for these answers.
Da,
In a city which is the symbol of Europe, the symbol of France, we can see that there are a lot of tourists. But until when will this situation continue? Until when can tourists easily come here with a Schengen visa and see 20-plus European countries? And until when will all these migrants of African and Middle Eastern descent come and live and work here? And will the French vote for change, or will the current situation and unity in Europe remain? It was the end of the discussion, and before saying goodbye, Marcus was showing me his office. Then I saw something strange. I saw a photo of Marx, the biggest leftist theorist in the office of the most famous radical right-wing party.
This is a famous local poet, yeah? And his poetry was in the local dialect. So he's very famous in Frankfurt for one sentence. Es will man nicht in der Kopenei, wie kann ein Mensch nicht von Frankfurt sei? So it means I can't understand how can one not be born in Frankfurt.
But it seemed like they had made a mistake. Well, everyone in this world has his own manifest.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en.
Russian officials say the strengthening of Ukraine's missile power by the United States will not change the war equations and will only prolong the crisis. They say the delivery of new missile launchers and long-range missiles by Washington to Kiev has not changed the reality of the war on the ground and will only prolong the conflict that was created in the first place by NATO and the West. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Defense News website has covered this story and tells us more. The Pentagon has announced that the United States will allow Ukraine to fire long-range missiles sent to the country at Kiev's discretion. The Pentagon said on Friday, 3rd of February, it is up to the government in Kiev to decide how to use new rockets being delivered for the U.S.-supplied HIMARS launchers. Pentagon's statement is a confirmation that the latest batch of munitions sent by the U.S. military to Ukraine to fight Russia will include ground-launched small-diameter bomb rockets. The Boeing-manufactured GLSDB, or ground-launched small-diameter bomb rockets, consist of a rocket motor mated with an airplane bomb, with an estimated range of up to 150 kilometers. Friday's announcement listed additional munitions for the HIMARS and precision-guided rockets, confirming the information leaked to Reuters news agency recently. Brigadier General Patrick Ryder told reporters that this indeed included the ground-launched small-diameter bomb rockets. Brigadier General Ryder also pointed out that the U.S. would not stand in the way of Ukrainians using the missiles to strike deep into Russia. He said on Friday, when it comes to Ukrainian plans on operations, clearly that is their decision. They are in the lead for those, he added. So I'm not going to talk about or speculate about potential future operations. But again, all along, we've been working with them to provide them with capabilities that will enable them to be effective on the battlefield. Meanwhile, the Reuters news agency claimed to have seen a Boeing document saying the first deliveries of the new munitions could be as early as spring of 2023. Bloomberg news agency cited unnamed government sources as saying the timeline for munitions delivery could be as long as 9 months, depending on when the U.S. Air Force issues the contract. Kiev has repeatedly requested the West to supply its forces with the MGM-140 Army Tactical Missile System rockets, which have a range of some 300 kilometers. Till now, the Ukrainian forces have used the HIMARS launchers supplied by the West to strike both military and civilian targets. The US and its allies have not directly taken part in the hostilities, but continue to send weaponry and ammunition to Kiev, amounting to over $32 billion, since Russia launched its special operation almost a year ago. Moscow has warned the West against flooding Ukraine with arms and munitions, asserting such a move will not stop Russia from reaching its objectives and would merely prolong the conflict and add to the casualties and destruction. The website of Business Insider has also covered this story and tells us more. Russia has warned if the United States supplies Ukraine with longer-range missiles, Washington will cross a red line and become a party to the conflict, nearly 1 year into Moscow's military operation in the ex-Soviet Republic. In a recent press conference, the Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said, "Russia reserves the right to defend its territory." She warned if Washington decided to supply longer-range missiles to Kiev, then it will be crossing a red line and will become a direct party to the conflict. The United States has already provided Kiev with advanced rockets capable of hitting targets up to 80 kilometers away, while so far refusing to publicly announce it would send rockets with more than double that range. Since the beginning of the war, the U.S. has been providing Kiev with military aid, including at least 16 HIMARS systems, four of which arrived back in August. HIMARS is a light multiple rocket launcher that can hit targets with precision. It is capable of launching all rockets specified in the multiple launch rocket system family of munitions. Its manufacturer, Lockheed Martin, says the system has a recognized and proven range of up to 300 kilometers. While Kiev is imploring for more Western weapons, Moscow says it sent troops to prevent Ukraine being used as a platform for Western aggression and to defend Russian speakers in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has time and again said the U.S. is prolonging the war in Ukraine as part of what he called Washington's efforts to maintain its global hegemony. Russia's Itatass news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. A senior Russian foreign ministry official has warned Western countries that supplying long-range and more advanced weaponry to Ukraine would cross Russia's red lines, and in that case, they have to be ready for a response. Director of the Russian Foreign Ministry's second CIS department, Alexei Polishchuk, said recently, "As for the red lines, we have already designated them. First of all, these are the deliveries of long-range or more powerful weapons to Kiev. Specific measures of response to the actions by the United States and its allies, supply weapons to the Kiev regime will be defined following a thorough analysis of the developing situation." The high-ranking Russian diplomat said Russia has sufficient tools to implement them. Recently, the U.S. State Department announced that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has repeatedly stated that it has no intention of taking direct part in the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. It claimed, "As long as the United States or our allies are not attacked, we're not going to get directly engaged in this conflict either by putting American troops to fight in Ukraine or attacking Russian forces. The United States is worried that the targeting Russia's territory and crossing Moscow's red line would lead to the escalation of the war and draw Washington into a direct conflict with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. Meanwhile, another senior Russian official has warned the supply of more advanced weaponry to Ukraine will just add fuel to the fire, culminating in more retaliatory strikes by Russian forces. The deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, who is also the country's former president, told journalist Nadana Friedrichsen in a written interview published on Saturday, 4th of February, that in case Ukraine receives new weaponry, all regions remaining under its rule will also burn. Dmitry Medvedev said more aid to Ukraine would mean more retaliation. Journalist Nadana Friedrichsen asked Medvedev whether the use of longer-range weapons might force Russia to negotiate with Kiev. Medvedev insisted that the use of longer-range weapons by Ukraine and its allies will not force Russia to hold negotiations. Dmitry Medvedev said the result will be just the opposite. He emphasized that Russia is ready to use all types of weapons in accordance with its doctrinal documents.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned. The duties of men inside the house include love for their family, establishing justice, and showing forgiveness and generosity towards their family members. These duties of men are so much important that all the infallibles stated beautiful recommendations about them. On the other hand, the women must be among the salihat. This means that they must be careful not to disclose the personal relations they have with their husband to others. This means that not even an iota of this relation must be made explicit in front of others, even the mahram ones. Showing love and passions between spouses is something personal, and the strangers must not witness such relations. This is because wife and husband are like clothes to each other. They must be careful only about each other, and their relations must be limited only to themselves. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Olema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
After intensive negotiations hosted by China, the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia have reached an agreement to restore diplomatic relations and reopen embassies in each other's capitals, 7 years after ties were severed over several issues. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. Iran and Saudi Arabia have restored ties after 7 years brokered by China. The deal is almost assuredly bad news for the United States and worse for Israel. The Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi commented on the restoration of ties by saying, "I think this sends very clear signals to the world that the Middle East belongs to the people of the Middle East and the fate of the region should be in the hands of its peoples." Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani, the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, expressed an all-round willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement the consensus, enhanced good neighborliness, and to jointly safeguard regional security. Ali Shamkhani said, "At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia, while consolidating the interests of the two countries. The security and well-being of the region and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over the last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as improvement of welfare of all the peoples of the region. Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and Iran have agreed to restore diplomatic relations, which will be followed up by reopening of embassies and diplomatic missions within a period not exceeding 2 months, according to protocol, resulting in the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the bilateral security cooperation agreement signed on 17th of April 2001, as well as the general agreement reached on 27th of May 1998, aimed at fostering ties in the economic, commercial, investment, technical and scientific fields. Saudi Arabia has also refused to issue entry visas to an Israeli delegation invited to a United Nations-sponsored tourism event in the kingdom, dashing Tel Aviv's hopes of warming relations with Riyadh in the foreseeable future. Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions internationally. In the Israeli regime, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, stating that the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There is no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the United States and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington. Iran sees opportunity to peel away U.S. allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory for Iranian foreign policy when it comes to Yemen and Saudi Arabia. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansarullah movement's dominance in Yemen. Détente between Iran and Saudi Arabia will result in regional stability, which is causing anxiety among Zionists. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of its allies, such as the United States. Other issues leading to severance of diplomatic ties between Tehran and Riyadh included the Saudi execution of the prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Namr Bagher al-Namr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Nevertheless, this was Hezbollah's reaction to the agreement. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader, reacted to restoration of ties between Tehran and Riyadh by saying, "It is an important development, of course, and if it proceeds in its natural course, so we don't rush things, it's still fresh news. It could open up horizons in the entire region, including in Lebanon." The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine and Syria, where it has played a destructive role. It remains to be seen whether this agreement between Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran will ensure the security of West Asia region and would translate into a decrease of US presence in this region, leading to its eventual withdrawal. China's Global Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. A landmark agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, mediated by China, to resume diplomatic ties and reopen embassies and diplomatic missions within 2 months after 7 years of no diplomatic ties between the two, was reached in Beijing on Friday, 10th of March, which experts hailed as a milestone in helping de-escalate tensions and restoring peace in the Middle East, as well as injecting stability into a volatile geopolitical landscape. The role that China plays in helping the two countries, which are long-term rivals, reach the agreement, won widespread praise from around the world after its announcement. This also shows that China's diplomatic philosophy that aims to promote peace and development is much more appealing than some countries' tactics of fueling confrontation to expand their own political domain in the Persian Gulf region. Experts told the Global Times that this is also one of the best practices under the Global Security Initiative, GSI, that China proposed, and it could have a far-reaching implication and demonstrative effect on other regions of the world that face similar problems of confrontation and conflict. The spokesperson for China's foreign ministry said on Saturday that China looks forward to seeing closer communication and dialogue between Saudi Arabia and Iran and stands ready to continue playing a positive and constructive role in facilitating such efforts. Their dialogue and the agreement set a good example of how countries in the region can resolve disputes and differences and achieve good neighbourliness and friendship through dialogue and consultation. This will help regional countries to get rid of external interference and take the future into their own hands. The spokesperson for China's foreign ministry noted that China will continue to contribute its insights and proposals to realizing peace and calm in the Middle East region. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Friday welcomed the deal and praised China, Oman and Iraq for promoting the talks. Countries including Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Iraq, Oman, Lebanon, Bahrain, among many others, also expressed positive sentiments towards the two countries' decision to resume diplomatic ties. The talks to resume diplomatic relations were conducted in Beijing from 6th of March to 10th of March, according to a trilateral statement from China, Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran. China's Xinhua news agency reported both Saudi Arabia and Iran extended their appreciation and thanks to Iraq and Oman for hosting multiple rounds of dialogue between 2021 and 2022, and to Chinese leaders and the Chinese government for hosting, supporting and contributing to the success of these talks. While congratulating the two sides on taking a historical step forward, the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi said China supports the two sides in making firm strides as agreed in the deal to work for the common bright future with patience and wisdom. As a reliable friend of the two countries, China will continue to play a constructive role, said Wang Yi, the Chinese foreign minister. Saudi Arabia cut its diplomatic ties with Iran in early 2016 in response to the attacks on Saudi Arabia's diplomatic missions in Iran, after the kingdom executed a prominent Shiite cleric, Sheikh Namr Bagher al-Namr. The Al Jazeera television network has also covered this story and tells us more. Iran and Saudi Arabia have agreed to re-establish diplomatic relations in a China-brokered deal that could have wide-ranging consequences, but building on it, analysts say, will prove the main challenge. The agreement signed in Beijing on Friday, 10th of March, said the two countries' foreign ministers will meet to discuss diplomatic missions within 2 months, marking the end of a 7-year rift. In Iran, the deal was generally welcomed, with senior officials praising it as a step towards reducing tensions and bolstering regional security. Media outlets mainly focused on how the deal signaled a defeat for the United States and for Israel. The rapprochement on Friday, 10th of March, was greeted with optimism by Iraq and Oman, who had previously helped mediate the talks, and many others in the region, while it was cautiously welcomed by the United States. China, of course, was the big victor of the agreement, as it bolstered the legitimacy of its reach across the region. Effectively, not only China became guarantor of this agreement, it also showed that the United States can no longer ignore China's role in the security arrangements of the Persian Gulf region, a region where energy reserves and passageways are more important to the Chinese economy than the United States.
Bazaar.
Almost everything around us is either made of plastic or has some plastic component. The use of plastic products in our daily lives is so widespread that many of our regular activities require a wide range of plastic accessories and products. Plastic is everywhere, from our homes to offices, businesses, and health centers. It is also used to make aeroplane parts, cars, trains, and so much more. Plastic is one of the most widely used materials due to its versatile features, which have boosted economies across the globe.
Well, hello there, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the programme that analyses profits, markets, industries, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to take a look at Iran's plastic production. We wanted to see how this market is doing and check out some major players in this sector. We will also peek into some of its contributions to the national economy. Enough said. Let's walk through today's Bazaar.
To become more familiar with plastic products and their production, we visited Parham Plast Aria. This company has been around for many years and is a major contender in the plastic products market. It makes hundreds of plastic-based products for a variety of uses. Some products are household plastic items such as baskets, dishes, utensils, and even larger things like chairs and tables. All things considered, this company provides some of the highest quality products found in the market. This is mainly because of its choice of raw material, which is rigorously tested for quality in its control labs. Moreover, raw materials such as polymers and additives are abundant inside the country. So, it doesn't have to look far for its feedstock. One of the advantages this company has is it controls the whole production and distribution process from design to sales.
In terms of household plastic products, there's always a thirst for newer and more stylish products coming from consumers. So companies must stay on their toes and create new molds each year to offer products that excite customers. However, making new molds is not always easy, and it can be an expensive process. That's why some companies choose to import molds instead, while others develop their own in R&D departments.
This company's research and development division is at the center of all productions. It is where new products are created. It is also tasked with keeping the company up to date in several fields, including production, consumer trends, and other domestic demands. Plus, it is no surprise that this unit is also where national and international standards for safety and durability are applied. It might be interesting to know that this company was a pioneer in setting standards through some of its products nationwide. Each year, this company evaluates the market to release the most recent product designs, giving it a competitive edge over other brands. Its massive production facilities can produce thousands of tons of products each year. As part of its future vision, this company is already expanding its facilities by launching a new production line. Once this new unit is up and running, it will add some 8,000 tons to its annual production. It also hopes to create its very own high-quality molds in the near future. This firm has overcome significant challenges over the years to enjoy its many achievements. Presently, this company is operating under its potential production capacity, and its ultimate goal is to use its full potential along the lines of exports.
Now, plastic is known as a group of synthetic or semi-synthetic materials created through the polymerization process. So, one of the most prominent ingredients in this mix is polymers, which are a derivative of petrochemical products that come from processing oil. It's not surprising that Iran has an ever-expanding polymer industry, given its large oil reserves.
We looked at some figures from the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Data showed that the polymer industry gets most of its feedstock from domestic petrochemical complexes. Plus, there are some 8,000 production units that make plastic products nationwide. These units have a total capacity to produce roughly 13 million tons annually. Some $3.3 billion worth of polymer products were exported last year. That's according to the National Plastic and Polymer Industries Association. Furthermore, it says these exports registered a 23% increase compared to the year before. The association also says exports in this sector make up roughly 7% of the country's non-oil exports. Iran's oil and petrochemical industries are subject to US-imposed sanctions. Still, the wide variety of their products and high international demand has kept the market floating. On a broader scale, switching attention to added value products to boost non-oil exports has been a transformative move for Iranian industries. Through this, the country has tapped into its advanced domestic capabilities and diversified its economy toward a knowledge-based one. Household appliances are universal and an integral part of our modern daily life. Nearly all households have some sort of appliance meant to bring ease and comfort to everyday domestic tasks. Additionally, these items assist us in preserving and preparing food, cleaning our clothes, and overall helping us stay healthy. In general, the near 100% penetration of appliances in homes shows how crucial they are for our way of life and just how abundantly available these items are.
This week, we will journey through Iran's massive home appliance industry. We wanted to see how this sector has developed over the years and check out some major players in this manufacturing arena.
To become more familiar with this sector, we decided to visit Steel Alborz Industries. It was established 30 years ago and has since become a well-known household brand. This company began its work by producing steel sinks. Later, it added to its product basket and began manufacturing stoves, ovens, stovetop ventilation systems, and taps, among other kitchen attachments. With two factories in Shiraz and one in the capital Tehran, its production facilities can make hundreds of thousands of units annually in over 200 different models. One of these factories is solely dedicated to various molds needed to create its stylishly modern products. Early on in its manufacturing journey, this company used to import steel stencil sheets from Europe. But after becoming a subsidiary of the second largest producer of galvanized steel sheets, it began purchasing most of its raw material domestically. The company uses the latest technology to manufacture its products. Its production lines are equipped with cutting-edge automated assembly systems managed by experienced staff. Nonetheless important is the use of high-quality raw materials and strong sustainable designs are two key components in guaranteeing the long life of these kitchen appliances.
Here is a short word on the machines used in manufacturing home appliances in Iran. Many production machines and automated systems, such as steel laser cutters, are domestically produced. Of course, that's not to say all of them are locally made. Some still need to be imported, but it is noteworthy just how much of this equipment is already available in domestic markets.
Research and development and quality control are critical activities of this manufacturing company. The R&D department is responsible for developing new products as well as monitoring the market and customers' needs. Its quality control division is built into its production facilities. Here, items are frequently checked and tested with the latest technologies to ensure manufacturing uniformity. As you might know, this also guarantees that each item is made exactly the same, which increases the quality of the final product. The R&D and quality control departments are also responsible for implementing national and international standards, which led the way for its exports. Currently, this company not only distributes its products nationwide, but also sends its items to neighboring and Eurasian markets. This company largely attributes its success to its highly experienced and specialized staff, who are in charge of various production processes. On the whole, it has created numerous job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it has dozens of representative agencies across the country. Like many in the home appliance industry, this company has faced many obstacles throughout the years. But its trump card has been its unique approach to solving these challenges. For example, the US-imposed sanctions were one that this company transformed into a domestic opportunity.
Now, Iran domestically produces a lot of raw materials needed in this sector, which spares local manufacturers from spending millions on imports. What's more, domestically supplying raw materials to the home appliance industry has helped it blossom. But you don't have to take my word for it. Here's an overview of the sector and its productions, including some insight into raw materials produced in Iran.
Iran is the 10th largest steel producer in the world, just behind Brazil. However, China is the undisputed producer with nearly 100 million tons of monthly output. That's just to give you an idea of how large the country's steel sector is. It's undoubtedly important, as the country's mammoth industry feeds numerous down-the-line sectors, including home appliance manufacturing. The World Steel Association's figures show that major Iranian steel mills produced nearly 30 million tons of crude steel and products last year. It might be interesting to know that over 30% of total productions are typically exported, generating millions in foreign revenue. But that's not the only industry that supplies raw materials to the home appliance sector. Petrochemical products, such as polymers, which are used to make plastic, also contribute to the production of home appliances. Iran's Home Appliances Manufacturers Union says some 15 million household appliances were produced in the country last year. That's far beyond the original production target of 12 million units set by the government. Meanwhile, Iran exports many of these products to neighboring regions, including Asia and Africa. Last year, the total value of exports was over $300 million, according to Iran's Trade Promotion Organization. All things considered, there is a lot to look forward to regarding Iran's expanding home appliance sector.
Okay, I shall now step aside for several minutes and let my good friend and colleague guide you on an educational adventure out on the field. Take it away.
Most of you have probably thought about biking to work or biking.